been working all your life, all weekends and overtime.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. Today is Tuesday, the 1st of September 2026, and thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio we've got Elena and Juliet. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Happy September. Happy September. Yeah, isn't it?
I did not realize that it was September today.
1st of September, how exciting.
Yeah, it's spring. We actually have an event at my work dedicated to spring today.
Oh,
so
that's
cute. How I knew that it was spring.
Well, when I left this morning, it wasn't as dark.
And it was quite warm.
And it was quite warm. So, yeah. But I feel like this happens every year where we do get maybe a nice day, a warm day here or there. And then it's pretty rainy and gets pretty cold right up until December. So
yeah, the false spring.
False spring, yeah.
Yesterday was lovely, though.
Yesterday was lovely. Does anyone have any spring intentions? Spring goals?
Ooh. I am trying to do some activities on my own at the moment. So
I love that.
That's so fun.
Yeah, I went to a book club by myself on Thursday and I went to see one of the MIFF screenings on my own as well. I'm just like trying to push myself outside my comfort zone a bit at the moment. Yeah.
And how has it been doing things on your own?
The movie, it was like good to go see it by myself, but then I didn't really have anyone to debrief with, and that I found that a little bit. Then I was just listening to other people debriefing to each other, and that was my way of participating. But I think last week it was good to go to the book club by myself, because then I had to actually talk to the people and not like just talk to my friend.
Maybe there are some maybe it's not about doing every activity on your own, but figuring out which ones are best to do solo.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's true.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any spring intentions?
Maybe not necessarily a spring intention, but something I've been doing for a while, for maybe about a year, is every week I try to talk to at least one stranger that I have to like go out of my way to talk to, which has definitely led to some very interesting conversations. some have been very lovely, some have been very strange. I spoke to this woman for like 45 minutes yesterday. Maybe it was yesterday. Actually, I don't really know. I had this whole conversation. I learned all about her family, all about you know, both sides of her family, about her living situation, about her dogs, and that was really lovely.
That's so nice. And where are you meeting these people?
I met her at the tram stop.
Oh, okay, great.
And so you just didn't get on the tram, or you talked to her?
We talked to her the whole way. She ended up being one stop before me to get off, and so I just spoke to her on the tram for the whole way.
That's good.
Wow, that's really lovely.
Mm. What about you?
Oh, gosh. I feel like both of you have had such lovely things to reflect on.
Purple?
Wearing more purple. Elena was complimenting my purple outfits today. I would say maybe a bit the opposite of you, Juliet, and do different things with people. I think, you know, we can be pretty social, but like sometimes it might be the same sorts of activities. I would like to do maybe some different sorts of activities with other people. I haven't decided what Exactly. That might be. But just broadening, I think, the scope of what socializing could be. I was thinking, because driving in, it was quite warm and sunny, I was like, I'd like to go on a walk or a hike soon.
Yeah.
Haven't been on one for a while, so I might reach out to a few friends and see who's interested in doing that. But yeah, I love doing things on my own, so I don't need to do any more of that stuff.
Well, no, I went on a hike on Sunday. I went to Lerdida Gorge. And actually, I did talk to some strangers. Me and my friend encountered a group of teenagers who got lost. And it was their first hike. And they didn't bring any water or a map. And they thought they were going for 1 hour. And it had been two already. And they kind of lost their way. And so they asked if we could walk back with them.
That's cute.
Show them the way, really, and we
cute.
Said yes.
That's cute. Imagine the debrief after that for them in the car talking about
strangers. Yeah, they were like asking us a lot of questions about hiking, and then like they were chatting between themselves. They were pretty funny, and then they listened to our conversation too, because then they were like, oh yeah, we were trying to talk to each other, but your conversation was more interesting, so we were just listening to you guys.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
I'm going hiking on Thursday.
There we go. It's the time to hike, everyone.
Yeah.
All right, let's have a chat about what's coming up on today's show. At 7:15, we'll be talking to Jana Favero, who is the Deputy Chief Executive Officer at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, or ASRC. She'll be joining us to reflect on 25 years since the Tampa affair, which permanently reshaped Australian politics and immigration law. At 7:30, we'll be speaking to Darcy Rouillard, who is an Australian Mauritian artist, and she'll be on the show to talk about the Wood Street Youth Art Prize, which is a biennial exhibition presented by Hobsons Bay City Council. At 7:45, we'll be replaying an interview between Jan from 3CR's Tuesday Home Time and Australian-Palestinian writer and filmmaker Aya Al-Kaisi about her latest play, The Return.
And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to speak to Mish Crilly and Nat Coppers from the Victorian Wildlife Alliance, and they're joining us following a landmark campaign over the weekend to humanely euthanise birds infected with H5N1 in Portland. And so we're going to hear about those efforts and the devastation caused by bird flu here in Victoria. And then finally, at 8:15, we're going to listen to a conversation between Joe Samuel King, the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy, with Hannah from Earth Matters, in an interview that originally aired on the 23rd of August.
So that's what's coming up on today's show. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty now. One, two, nitty-gritty now, yeah, boom.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, 1st of September 2026. Nepal's rescue teams, aided by Chinese and Indian experts, are racing to save more than 900 workers believed to be trapped underground at hydropower projects hit by the devastating flash floods. Nepali officials said on Monday that the focus was on reaching the workers in about a dozen hydropower project tunnels blocked by mud and rock debris. The unprecedented deluge of ice, rock, mud and debris on the Nepal-Tibet border on Wednesday, caused by a glacier collapse, has killed 903 people, with 4,247 people missing in Nepal, its disaster authority said. The flood has also wreaked havoc across the border in Tibet, where at least 16 people have died and 546 are missing, according to Chinese authorities. The Red Cross has estimated that more than 90,000 people are likely to have been affected by the disaster, which China has linked to the effects of climate change. Rescue operations have been suspended several times since Friday because of bad weather and concerns that a lake formed across the Nepal-China border by the disaster could trigger new flooding after it began overflowing into Nepal's rivers.
In other news, the Northern Territory government has seemingly rejected a Commonwealth offer to split the cost of acquiring Darwin's largest homeless center, even as hundreds of vulnerable women and children face homelessness in the latest open conflict between the Northern Territory and federal government. The housing future of hundreds of Territorians was thrown into limbo into July after the Country Liberal Party government gave Yili Rurung Housing Aboriginal Corporation 90 days to vacate its short-stay accommodation premises after a failure to agree on a price for the property. The Northern Territory has the highest rate of homelessness in the country, at almost 12 times the national average. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people comprise 87% of the territory's homelessness population. In a statement last month, then Aboriginal Housing Northern Territory Chief Executive Leanne Catton said many vulnerable people in the territory relied on the shelter to provide a safe place to stay while accessing medical care, escaping violence, connecting with services, or taking steps towards stable housing. Also in the news, more than 450 University of Sydney alumni and current staff have signed a letter calling for a mass meeting to discuss the university's ties to Israel amid the concerns of a crackdown on free speech. The letter, submitted by Chancellor David Thodey on Tuesday, accused the university of failing to respond meaningfully to the ongoing genocide in Gaza, which it said to represent a profound moral failure. The signatories, among them recipients of Australian AM and OAM honours, a former deputy vice chancellor and two politicians, are calling for a meeting of convocation of a body of compromising alumni, staff and members of the university's governing senate. Campus atmosphere has remained tense since an anti-genocide student encampment was removed in 2024. That same year, the University of Sydney managed to upgrade its CCTV system, installed additional cameras, and introduced restrictions on students setting up stalls. University staff also report being unfairly accused of anti-Semitism for protesting Israel's actions in Palestine. The letter's organizers drew attention to a significant New South Wales Supreme Court ruling this month that found criticism of Israel or Zionism did not constitute anti-Semitism. Justice Desmond Fagan was particularly critical of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which includes criticism of Israel and Zionism and is favored by the pro-Israel lobby.
And finally, in headlines, new analysis from the Australia Institute has revealed that 2 million Australians delay or skip specialist appointments each year. Among this number, half were due to the increasingly unaffordable costs of seeing a specialist. Specialist appointment costs have risen faster than inflation and wage growth. Lower socioeconomic populations or those with a chronic illness or disability, as well as people living in rural and remote areas, face the highest barrier to accessing specialist care. Luke Slawomirski, postdoctoral research fellow at the Australia Institute, remarked, "Seeing a specialist has become a luxury rather than a way for any Australian to receive treatment for a serious health condition." He continued, "It has become a two-tier system where people who can pay often move quickly, while people who cannot pay are forced to wait or miss out altogether." These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 1st of September 2026, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersects where we're both disabled. It doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo-woo!
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already, hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM. We're just trying to get our first guest on the line. So we're going to just go to another break and we'll come back with our first guest in just a moment.
We have got something very special here up at Camp Sovereignty, Grandmother Moon, Full Moon, at end of the month. Camp Sovereignty presents Rock Against Racism. Remember the Rock Against Racism back in the day? Yeah, so from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m, Sunday the 30th of August, at Camp Sovereignty, Linlithgow Avenue, not the King Domain, Melbourne. Rock Against Racism is a free concert held in honour of all those ready to stand strong against the racist attack on the camp. Come dance and spread the love, hey? Rock Against Racism, 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. on the 30th of August, Grandmother Moon Night at Camp Sovereignty.
The 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and we are now joined on the phone by Jana Favero, who is the Deputy Chief Executive Officer at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. She joins us this morning to reflect on 25 years since the Tampa Affair, which permanently reshaped Australian politics and immigration law by launching offshore detention and hardline border protection policies that continue to this day. Thank you for joining us this morning, Jana.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to join you.
I'm sure many of our listeners would remember everything about the Tampa Affair, but I was wondering if you could start by briefly summarising what happened 25 years ago.
Yeah, so 25 years ago last week, there was a boat that had left Indonesia with 433 people seeking asylum from Hazara, from Afghanistan, who were en route to Australia. For many people who do flee from Afghanistan, sometimes the only route to get out to safety is to cross overland borders, sort of Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, and then try to get to safety in Australia, which is what these 433 people seeking asylum were doing. Their boat got into distress in the ocean, and a Norwegian tanker, the Tampa, was passing, responded to that distress and rescued the people. all very humane and exactly what anyone would do when you see someone in trouble. The Tampa then requested permission to enter into Australian waters to be able to take the people who were seeking safety on the boat. There were pregnant women, there were people who'd been at sea for days who were incredibly dehydrated, a couple who were unconscious and really unwell, and requested to bring them into Australian waters. But unfortunately, at the time, the issue of boat people seeking asylum by sea was really hotly contested. John Howard was the Prime Minister. An election was coming up. Pauline Hanson was on the rise, and there was this concern of taking votes away. So it became a political issue, and John Howard, as Prime Minister, refused entry of the Tampa into Australian waters. And so unfolded this humanitarian crisis on board the Tampa and triggered international condemnation because, as signatories to the Refugee Convention, which Australia are, you have to offer safe passage and safety to people when fleeing, but we did not. And so triggered treatment of people seeking asylum, being demonised, and has set the scene for how we've treated them for 25 years since then.
Yeah, and so on that note, I was wondering if you could tell us more about the cruel and inhumane policies that have stemmed from the Tampa affair. What followed after was what was known back then as the Pacific Solution. And since then, we've had things like offshore processing, the fast track process, all of which has been broadly bipartisan. So, Jana, what can you tell us about some of these policies that have come from both Labor and Liberal governments since?
It really triggered a political response to a humanitarian crisis, and that is what has set the scene. It's said often that politics poisons policy, and this is a prime example of that. So not only did the politics interfere, but there was bipartisan support. Kim Beazley, the then opposition leader, came out very early on saying, "I support the government's actions here." So that started that bipartisan cruelty. You also then had the Prime Minister, who they tried to rush legislation through Parliament in 45 minutes that would create laws that would mean that politicians could make decisions that even lawyers couldn't contest, which was totally outrageous. It was actually even too far for Kim Beazley and the Labor Party because they opposed those laws at the time. But rushed laws, bipartisan cruelty, this notion that you need to be cruel to protect the borders, which is a total untruth. John Howard, very famously as Prime Minister, said, "We will choose who comes to this country." Mm. And that is what has set the mindset for people seeking asylum. And rather than responding in a way that reflects our values of compassion and kindness and fairness, our country, bipartisan, has responded in a way with cruelty. So offshore detention was established, meaning anyone who sought asylum by sea would then be sent offshore, Nauru and Papua New Guinea. We had this whole focus on stronger borders, stronger borders, stronger borders, this obsession with the number of people who are arriving by sea. And, you know, one thing I have to say is at the time, you know, politicians were saying, "We have to do this to stop people coming." And the one thing I know of ASRC working for 16 years is people still come because people will do whatever they have to flee. No matter how cruel you are, people will do whatever they can to get their family to safety. And so this thread of cruelty and treating people seeking asylum from a viewpoint of punishment and deterrence has really then shaped all of our asylum and refugee policy over the past 25 years, and it has been bipartisan. Mm. So it's offshore detention, it's now laws that have been passed about how people are treated in detention, mobile phones being confiscated, being no resettlement, that anyone who comes by sea will never be resettled in Australia. So it really is a very dark point in our history that has real human consequences and suffering. To this day, there are still 100 people in detention on Nauru and 25 men and their families who sought asylum over 14 years ago who are still in PNG, plus 700 who are in the community in Australia in limbo. So the human consequences of those decisions 25 years has continued. Mm-hmm.
And I was
wondering, sorry, they are very long answers because it is very complicated.
No. Apologies. No. It's really good to really understand, like you said, the very real impacts of something that happened 25 years ago. So thank you so much for going into detail with these answers. I was wondering if you could talk about as well the dual roles of the government and the media, the mainstream media, for instilling fear in the communities. In particular, I'm thinking about the so-called Children Overboard affair, when the Howard government falsely claimed that refugees had deliberately thrown their children overboard, and more recently, mainstream media, you know, referring to focusing on the criminality of people who have settled in Australia. So, yeah, what can you tell us about the government and the media and their roles in instilling fear in the Australian communities?
Well, scapegoating people seeking asylum and migrants is something that our political leaders and media do often. We can see it even currently and back 25 years ago. And I think it really did start with Children Overboard, which was, as you said, when the Howard government accused people seeking asylum of throwing their children overboard. I mean, you can demonise someone and saying, oh, look, they were willing to throw their kids overboard to get to safety. If you've got that then in your mindset, you really think, oh, these aren't people who we want to come here. And that's exactly what they're trying to create. They're trying to create fear. I was even just recently reflecting on some of the headlines at the time. Like, I remember I was protesting on the streets 25 years ago around Children Overboard, around Tampa, around the government's actions, and all the headlines were talking about needing to keep our community safe from those who are coming here, really othering people seeking asylum, like not even showing their faces, not even exploring their names, but just talking about the numbers, talking about the awful things that they would apparently do. It's targeting, it's demonising. These are decisions that are in control of the government. For example, even now looking at housing, I mean, the government can solve housing. The government's responsible for cost of living, but it's blaming others and creating fear and division because that gives more power. At the end of the day, this is about power and control of governments, and they're using fear as a tool to try and manipulate the community. And also the media are quite often responsible, like the headlines at the time, even the headlines now, the obsession with covering every single word that comes from Pauline Hanson or One Nation at the moment, and that was happening 25 years ago. So demonisation of refugees and people seeking asylum, and now more broadly migrants, is also a theme that has continued, and unfortunately a lot of mainstream media have been complicit in it. I was, you know, seeing interviews with the editors at the time of The Australian, and they were saying 25 years ago, oh, the Prime Minister only had a choice. And that's, I think that that is what is really reflective of that time, is that there was a choice to lead with compassion, as the Norwegians did, as Bob Brown did, as the only Senate Greens candidate in Parliament. They chose to lead with compassion and humanity, but there was a very calculated political choice to use fear and to demonise people seeking asylum to win votes.
Mm, yeah. And, you know, we could continue talking about the positioning of our safety versus, you know, without even considering the safety of those who have fled their countries to seek asylum in a different country. We could also talk about the economic impacts and the finances of offshore detention and everything like that. But unfortunately, we're running out of time, Jana. So just very quickly to finish our interview today, it was also 25 years ago that the ASRC was founded. So what are some ongoing and currently urgent issues that are faced by refugees and asylum seekers today that you're working on at the ASRC?
And look, thank you for mentioning that, because the flip side to all of this is that the ASRC has been around for 25 years. The only reason we exist is because of community donations and volunteers. We don't accept any federal government funding. So that is the antidote to all of this fear-mongering and division. And some of the biggest things that we're facing at ASRC, I mean, we just saw last week that the government were looking to slash humanitarian places. Luckily, they reversed it quickly because of the backlash. We've currently got people who are being forced into poverty and destitution because they don't have the right to work, they don't have the right to Medicare. And when you're seeking asylum in the community in Australia, you have absolutely zero access to any form of Centrelink. So if you can't work, but you can't access any social services, you are forced into poverty, and that's where ASRC steps in. We are people's supermarket. We are people's legal centre. We are people's medical clinic, because they would not be able to access those basic services anywhere else, simply because they're seeking asylum. So it still is very much a policy-based in punishment. We're supporting people seeking asylum in the community, also in immigration detention, as I mentioned earlier, those who are still in offshore detention. So we are needed as much as ever, there are all these attacks, and also the way people seeking asylum are being spoken about in the mainstream, it's unsafe for them. So we really appeal to the values in people of kindness, generosity, compassion and fairness, and that is what governments and media should do rather than leading into fear and division. But we provide direct service delivery to people to make sure that their rights are upheld and they can access very basic services while they're navigating the confusing system of seeking asylum.
Well, thank you so much, Jana, for joining us on 3CR today to reflect on 25 years since the Tampa affair and the ongoing impacts that that has had on refugees and asylum seekers trying to start a new life in this country. We really appreciate your time this morning.
No, thank you for covering it.
We've been speaking to Jana Favero, Deputy Chief Executive Officer at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, about the Tampa affair that took place 25 years ago and the policies of cruelty that have come since. You can go to asrc.org.au for more information about the organisation. We'll be back with our next interview in just a moment.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jajarong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
We are back now for our next interview with Darcy Huyar, who is an Australian Mauritian artist whose practice revolves primarily around textiles and sculpture, though she is constantly expanding to include more mediums. Her art investigates a variety of themes, including the materiality of metal, feminism, craft as art, and the relationship between metal and textiles. Darcy joins us on the show this morning to talk about the Wood Street Youth Art Prize, which is a biennial exhibition presented by Hobsons Bay City Council. It celebrates the diverse perspectives, creative practices, and artistic ambitions of young people across Melbourne's West. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Darcy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. To start off with, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a bit more about yourself and your art practice.
Well, like you said, I explore sculpture. I was involved in the Wood Street Youth Art Prize 2 years ago, with the two of the first four bronzes that I ever made, that I did at my time at RMIT University. And I've been exploring a whole bunch of new things this past year. Sticking with bronze, it has a special place in my heart. But also going back to some ceramic-based mediums and doing some casting stuff right now in plaster and investigating other materials that I could be casting to make sculpture with, but also wanting to go back to and reopen up in that textiles area of my practice that's really important to me and has a very special place in my heart, looking into the all different things around feminism, including bodily autonomy and women's reproductive rights, as well as the history of female artists and the overlooked history of female artists who've been dismissed or disregarded as talent or skilled artists, and that are just kind of coming back into perspective and promoting these or forgotten or overlooked artists or persecuted artists from history.
And so you said that 2 years ago you participated in the Wood Street Youth Art Prize. I did mention a little bit about it in my introduction, but I was wondering if you could tell us more about what this Youth Art Prize is all about and what it was like being part of it.
Well, it was quite funny for me, actually. I've just completed my master's of teaching secondary to be an art teacher, and I actually found out about the Wood Street Youth Art Prize on my very first placement at a school in the West, and it was kind of my last opportunity to join. I unfortunately hadn't heard about it previously, and I was 25 at the time. I turned I turned 26. I just kind of made the mark, and I'm so happy that I did. It's such a great opportunity for young people to exhibit. It's eligible for people, for artists from the age 14 to 25. So really, to me, even though I was only involved in it when in my 20s, at that kind of cap age, being a part of this exhibition and seeing the works of students from and artists from all different ages, and giving that opportunity for students in school, looking at it through the lens of a teacher and someone who was a student, who, you know, if you think back on a art practice, you know, I've been an artist since I was doing art in school. I think we all have. So seeing these young people, such a diverse range, given this opportunity to exhibit their artworks and connect with each other as well, is just wonderful.
Mm. And I guess, yeah, it's so great that you have multiple perspectives here as someone who participated in this Youth Art Prize, who has been making art as a young person and now has a perspective of someone entering the teaching profession and can see, I guess, the growth and development of young people's artistic practice. Why is it important to provide and fund opportunities for young people to express themselves?
Without art, what can we say of culture, right? So if we don't instill an appreciation, a love, and the opportunity for young people to express themselves through art, to share their art, to facilitate art-making practice and creativity, then personally I feel that we lose a massive part of our culture we don't fund these opportunities. So, you know, this is a little tangent that I quite often go on, but if we look back throughout history, different parts of history, and compare them to today, where art is separated from maths, is separated from science, is separated from engineering, is separated from writing, etc. But then historically, take, for example, take, for example, periods of our history where these things were considered as one, where writers were scientists, were anatomists, were painters, were sculptors, were inventors, like Leonardo da Vinci. And so if we don't find opportunities for people of all ages to pursue art, to engage in art practices, to be engaging their creative mind, then we are losing opportunities and development in all areas of specialization at any age.
Yeah, and like what you were saying before, no, it definitely does. And, you know, when you were describing your art practice and the themes that you explore through your practice, it just shows that young people have so many ideas and topics and issues that they are passionate about that they would like to explore through their art. And, yeah, like you said, it's such an important part of our culture. There's an exhibition happening. I know that you're hosting a Q&A as well, Darcy. So for any listeners out there who would like to attend, who would like to learn more about the exhibition, where can they go to find out more information? And yes, when is this exhibition actually on?
Yes, so the Wood Street Youth Art Prize opens this Friday, September 4th, the opening event starting from at 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. The exhibition is open from Thursdays to Saturdays from 12 to 5 p.m. until the 19th of September. And on that 19th of September, the last day, there will be a closing event, which includes my interview with three of the featured artists, Maya Kirk, Charlie English, and Justin Enrico. If you'd like to learn more, just simply search Wood Street Youth Art Prize. It comes up in association with Hobson's Bay, as you've mentioned, and it's right near Laverton Station, so it's very accessible. Please come check it out. We'd love to see anybody come by and check it out.
Well, thank you so much for your time on the program today, Darcy. We'll pop all of that information in our show notes on our podcast later today. But for now, we've really enjoyed speaking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Darcy Huillard, an Australian Mauritian artist, about the 2026 Wood Street Youth Art Prize taking place from 4th to the 16th September at the Wood Street Art Space. You can find out more about the exhibition by visiting the Hobson Bay City Council website, and you can also find Darcy on Instagram at Darcy Beaux-Arts. That's Darcy underscore B-E-A-U-X underscore A-R-T-S. We are now going to go to a song.
Do you work in a brothel, massage shop, escort agency, fetish house or dungeon, cam studio or porn set, sauna, short-time hotel, outdoors or on the street, or in any other space where sex work happens? Recent changes to Victorian sex work laws mean that sex workers now have more options for how and where we can work and who we can work with.
To find out more about Victoria's new sex work laws, contact Vixen, Victoria's statewide peer-only sex work organisation, 100% by and for all sex workers on 039-070-9050.
And talk to another sex worker about what the partial decriminalisation of sex work means for you, your workplace and your community. Or check out the Decrim Info Hub at vixen.org.au. Vixen is a 3CR supporter.
On last week's episode of Tuesday Home Time, Jen spoke to Australian Palestinian writer and filmmaker Ala Aikaisi about her latest play, The Return. They spoke about her move from Jordan to Australia, her studies in the arts, and her creative practice. This interview first aired on 3CR on Tuesday, the 25th of August, 2026.
The Return is a play by award-winning Palestinian Australia writer and director Ala Aikaisi. Inspired by martyred Palestinian sisters killed by an Israeli strike in Gaza in 2024. Described as part dream, part revelation, it is a haunting and visually stunning theatrical experience that transports audiences beyond the limits of time and space. I spoke with Aya yesterday and began by asking her about her background prior to moving to Australia in her early 20s, and explained that the focus of our interview is the play, The Return, but her career as a writer began in Jordan. And I asked her, were her family Palestinian refugees?
From the West Bank, from Khalil, Hebron, yeah. In the 60s, yeah, they migrate or they were expelled.
Was it difficult to be political in Jordan in support of Palestine?
Look, I mean, like, it's the common culture, not like it's nothing to be political about. Like, if you're in Jordan, you know, like, what happened. So it's different from being in the Western world or in a different country. It's a different situation in general, yeah.
But you do get lots of information about what has been going on for many years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, this is what you live with. Like, you live with the news, you live with the politics. It's kind of, different from here.
What was the decision, or who made the decision to come to Australia?
I came to Australia with my ex-husband. It was a decision that we took together at the time, yeah.
But before that, you were working as a writer, a director?
Like, I always wrote at university and stuff. Like, I've been writing since I was really young. And, yeah, when I came here, I studied filmmaking, and then I started developing more my writing and my filmmaking skills.
And what was your work in Jordan? You won an award for a film or a play?
My awards were for films and writing as well. Screenwriting and, yeah.
When you came here, were you are you going to continue with films, or are you going to branch out to other areas of art?
No, no, I came here and I studied filmmaking here. I wanted to work more on my skills, and that's why I studied filmmaking.
And when you came here, it's how many years ago now?
It's been 16 years almost, yeah.
And did you become part of the advocacy for what was happening back in Palestine?
I don't consider myself being an advocate. I'm an artist. I try to make art. I try to bring people to the reality through art.
So you see art as an activism?
It is. In a way, it can be a tool, but it's also, in, like, I try to keep it entertaining. I try to keep it not purely activism, because I enjoy writing and I find healing in it. And it's not my activism. It's I was writing before being active.
And what have you been involved with prior to the return? What work have you done here?
I've made short films. My first short film was A Pink Swing. It was a film that I shot here in Sydney. And it was about Palestine, based on a story from a Palestinian writer. His name is Ziad Khaddash. It's a true story that happened to him when he was younger. And it was adapted through the building of the apartheid wall in the West Bank.
So that's a fair while ago.
That was in 2012, yeah.
And your play, The Return, is described as part dream and part revelation. How long were you thinking about it before you actually decided that you would do this play?
Look, the whole story started at the beginning of the genocide in Gaza. I saw a video of a Palestinian father from Gaza. His name is Marwan Abu Samra. And at the time, he was pleading to the world to help him save his daughter, Nagam. Nagam was a famous karate champion from Gaza, and she was very well known. She competed and she raised the Palestinian flag in many international platforms. But unfortunately, at the time, she was in a hospital with an amputated leg, in a coma with many fractures in her head. And her father, Marwan, was next to her, and he was on over social media trying to ask the world to move and to for the humanitarian organizations to help him get Nagam out of Gaza. So the video was really horrific, and I kept following his story. He kept talking to the media for many weeks because they didn't even have antibiotics. And after weeks of pleading, he managed to get her to Egypt, but her situation was really bad, so she only survived for a few days, and she died. And at the same strike, he also lost Roseanne, his other daughter. So he lost both daughters. And I looked him up on social media, and I told him, I want to tell your story. I was really influenced and moved by his story. So he welcomed me. I went to Egypt, and I started learning about his story. I started making a documentary, which is still in the process. And then during my other time where I'm not working on the documentary, I start writing his story, which is a different kind of reality I created, which this is how The Return started. So in The Return, it's not factual. In The Return, Marwan will be speaking to the clouds, and he thinks that God issued a decree where all the martyrs are returning through the clouds. And he goes in this real journey where he kind of talks to his daughter through the cloud, and she attempts to heal his heart and to confront the killers and try to kind of find a meaning behind everything that happened to him and the loss that he faced.
Where is he now?
He's still in Egypt.
Did he hope to see that play somewhere?
He couldn't read it. And I asked him to read the script. He couldn't read it. Which is very common in a lot of the Palestinians. It's like their mental health is not capable of kind of facing the reality still. But he's very supportive of my work. He's always in touch. He always thank me for trying to bring his voice to the world, and at least for now, to the people in Australia. So yeah, we kept in touch. We almost talk very often. Yeah.
Has it been performed anywhere else except here in Victoria?
It has been performed in Sydney before last year, in December last year, we had many shows and they were very successful. We were sold out for most of the shows. And now we're bringing it again to Sydney during the Fringe Sydney Festival. And after that, to Victoria, Melbourne, and yeah, region of Victoria.
Can you describe some of the responses to the play? People who maybe contacted you and just told you what they thought of your work?
Yeah, well, the responses have been really powerful. Like, we had, everyone was like coming to us, hugging us, feeling some kind of healing or a lot of tears, even though I try not to make it sad. I'm trying just to bring the mirror to the reality. But many people put us on more responsible situation because they told us you have to bring it to everyone. Everyone should see this play because for them, it's brought the reality closer to their eyes, closer to their hearts. So that's why we felt more responsible to kind of continue with this project, even though it's very tiring and we don't have funding, we don't have, you know, the tools to continue, but we do it in our own capacity because we felt responsible because of the wonderful feedback that we got from people.
How does it make you feel, or how did it make you feel when you finally got this play together and realized the impact that it could have on people?
It helps a lot with my helplessness because as many people watching the genocide for the last 3 years, the helplessness was maybe the most overwhelming feeling because we see a live stream genocide and we don't know what to do. We don't know how to, like, we protest, we go, we sign petitions, we ask politicians to raise their voices, but unfortunately nothing has changed. So for me, at least that helps me a lot with kind of, I feel like I'm actually doing something, even though I don't feel it's enough because things has to change. But at least with the collective power that art makes, like that brings people together, I hope that can make change. Maybe people who watch the play can make bigger decisions that I can have. So this way I feel like I'm raising awareness, I'm bringing people together, I'm opening their eyes. So it does help a lot mentally, emotionally. Yeah.
Did you have any say in where the play is being performed? Or was that up to the activists here in Victoria?
It's not like activist kind of work. It's artwork. Like, my group we're not activists. We don't want to be called activists because we want to deliver art. And it's not like... We did it in our own capacity here in Sydney. And in Melbourne, we had the support and the amazing team of the Free Palestine Melbourne who's trying to help us bring it to Melbourne. They sponsored the play. They were amazing. But when we start the whole thing, it's just, you know, a group of us. We want to do something from artistic perspective and to deliver a strong message. Yeah. It was up to us, like, choosing venues and stuff. Like, it was us, like, yeah, connecting with venues.
And you've been in contact with the arts community here in Melbourne?
Yeah. Like, I've been in touch. Like, I put a media release with, like, for the people, like, in the industry to come and watch us. And I'm trying to bring as many people. That you don't have to be pro-Palestine or you don't have to know a lot to come to watch the play because at the end it's artwork. I want to target, like, I want to bring those people from the art industry, from all sorts of life to come and watch it.
If there was one message in your play, can you describe what that would be?
I would say, let's be human again. I want people to come together and reflect deeply on that we all come from the same source, we all one, and the divisions are not helping anyone.
Do you have another play in mind after this one?
I have a play dedicated for Nagam, the karate champion. This one about her sister, Roseanne. And the other one, which I already wrote, it's called Nagam of Gaza, which means Melody of Gaza. It's more dedicated about Nagam's life as a karate champion who was fighting before even the genocide. She was trying to go and represent Palestine in different places, but Israel wouldn't even give her a visa. So just to see how she fought before she was killed, and then she ended up being killed through the genocide, even though she had big dreams and she wanted to travel, she wanted to represent Palestine. And I'm working on the Return Project. Is an initiative, is an organization that tries to make art about Palestine, to preserve the narrative and to preserve the Palestinian culture and art. So we're trying to keep doing this in different forms.
And of course, the story of these two sisters is the story of many young people in Palestine.
Absolutely. And that's like, I'm focusing on their story as individuals to take us out of the statistics and the numbers. We're not just the headlines or the numbers, we are people. And by focusing on one story or two stories that bring people to the reality, they can relate more. So it's not just news, it's not just content on social media. They are true people. And that's why I'm dedicating all my energy to this story, and I'm giving it all.
Thank you so much. And I'm sure it will be a success.
Thank you. I really hope so. And I'm sure, yeah, it's been receiving a lot of good response so far.
We've been listening to a conversation between Tuesday Home Times, Jan, and Australia-Palestinian writer and filmmaker Ala Al-Kaisi about her play, The Return. The Return will play in theatres across Melbourne and regional Victoria from September 15th. It is the first time the play will be performed in the state following a successful Sydney run in 2025. The dates are September 15th, 16th, 17th, and 20th at Brunswick Mechanics Institute, September 18th at Ballarat Performing Arts Centre, September 19th at Chandler Community Centre in Keysborough, and September 22nd, the Fee Broadway Theatre in Castlemaine.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
We're now speaking to Nat Coppice and Mish Crilly, who are from the Victorian Wildlife Alliance, an organisation who are advocating for a more wildlife-friendly government in this year's state election. Mish has a long history of rescue for both wildlife and hard-to-rehome animals, and has decades of experience of advocacy for wildlife, farmed animals, and feminism. Nat also has a long history of animal advocacy, including the campaign to end duck shooting, and is a coordinator with Advocacy for a Kinder World. Nat and Mish join us today following a landmark campaign over the weekend to humanely euthanise birds infected with H5N1 in Portland. And Mish was part of the on-the-ground efforts, and they're here to discuss the huge devastation caused by the bird flu and what the Vic Wildlife Alliance is doing to attend to this disaster. Thank you so much for joining us, Nat and Mish.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Well, to start off, Nat, can you tell us a little bit about how the Victorian Wildlife Alliance has come together, and kind of what some of the aims are?
Yeah, it kind of grew organically, just because wildlife has been treated so abysmally by our Labor government for the past few years. They're just exploited and seen as a commodity and not just valued for their existence the way that general people feel that they should be. So a number of advocacy and rescue groups have come together, and we're just working to support each other and to work on education and advocacy amongst candidates and MPs to try to create a more wildlife-friendly government this November.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, yeah, when you can all come together, you can bring that knowledge and, create a bigger platform and, bring attention to the issues. And I know at the moment, we are facing, quite the crisis in Victoria with the spread of bird flu across, Victoria and also the rest of the country. But Mish, could you tell us a little bit about, what's actually going on and how this is affecting wildlife?
Yeah, sure. So there's a crisis happening down in like Portland and Nelson area, and it's sort of starting to slowly spread further east. We're finding a mass mortality, particularly of crested terns, and the community is absolutely devastated to witness it. The government's really not come to the table with, like, collecting any of the dead birds or even euthanising the ones that are sick and suffering. So they're just being left to kind of rot on the beaches. So it's devastating for the locals to witness. It's devastating for the tourists to witness. The government's just not coming to the table.
Yeah, that's really awful to be seeing that playing out right in front of you in your community. And, of course, it seems like, the government hasn't done anything, which has led to the community and volunteers to take the lead. And Mish, can you talk us through, kind of what happened over the weekend and what actions were taken, to address the situation?
Yeah, so we were contacted by some wildlife rescuers who are trained in humane euthanasia and trained in proper PPE, gear. They're fully set up with their all that gear, so they know what they're doing. And they contacted us to ask us if we would support them in basically setting up a space where we can euthanize the sick animals and we can collect the dead bodies of those that have passed, just so that they're not vectors for disease, because this virus can live in the body of a deceased animal for months, and so to leave them there is just basically making the problem worse for wildlife. And there's studies to back that up. Like, the quicker that you remove dead bodies, the more likely you are to stop the spread. So we supported some wildlife rescuers through some humane euthanasia, which is, that can be quite confronting, but it's also really confronting to watch, dozens and dozens of birds suffering and sick, and birds that are in the water still, and they're drowning while they're still alive because they've got no energy to get out of the water. So it's very confronting.
Yeah, that does just really sound horrific to be witnessing firsthand. And Nat, can you speak a little bit more about, what are the species that are being impacted by bird flu? And, is it impacting species beyond just the bird population as well?
There have been a few cases of other species. There's been a seal and a fox, and I believe there's been a record of a raven and a magpie. So, we know it's going to spread. This disease has been around for years in other countries. Australia and New Zealand are the last countries to be affected. So we have a lot of information about how it's, how it's likely to spread over time. Currently, it is the crested terns, the seabirds who have been the most affected by it, which is devastating to see. But it's only going to be a matter of time until it spreads into other populations, especially when you do have, vast areas where the bodies are left behind for, predators to, unfortunately engage with, and, people walking their dogs, et cetera, to be, playing with or, approaching. So, currently it's predominantly in the seabirds, the terns, but, it is only a matter of time till it spreads further, sadly.
Yeah, that's
really boring to hear that it is impacting the seabirds already so much, and that it does have that risk of transmitting to other populations as well. And Mish, can you sort of speak a bit more about maybe the government's overall response to bird flu? Like, what actions are they taking? Are there vaccination programs happening? What are they doing?
So they are vaccinating certain species. So you might have seen that they're vaccinating penguins down at Phillip Island. There are other species on the list. So, for example, there's a gannet colony down at Point Danger, just next to, like, the Portland main area. Gannets are highly susceptible to bird flu. Those birds are on the list, but they have to kind of wait until they can, they're nesting before they can sort of catch them. So it's not an ideal situation. So removing, like, the bodies from that area is just common sense. If you're removing them, that would make sense. But the government's just not coming to the table. Basically, they're putting money into preparing the chicken industry or poultry industry, and not putting a wildlife response in properly. Now, without, like, recognizing that a wildlife response helps prevent an industry response. So, you know, they're leaving wildlife to suffer, and potentially spreading it to industry anyway. There's also lots of other things they could be doing. They could be looking at, you know, conservation programs, and BirdLife of Australia have been asking for a $200 million investment into bird flu response. Last week the government put a little measly $20 million in. So, you know, not nearly what we need. We need more money behind this. We need more of a wildlife response. We need to stop allowing wildlife to suffer. But it just seems like they're just more interested in industry than anything.
Yeah, it does seem like, that priority is being put into industry over wildlife, which is really concerning. And, would you be able to speak a bit more, Nat, about, I guess in terms of the Victorian Wildlife Alliance, what are you going to be campaigning for in the lead up to the election?
We're currently working on our 10 asks at the moment. The problem is that there's so many areas of wildlife that need support, but certainly habitat restoration is vastly important. Stopping the convenience killing. So, you know, the ATCWs, the convenience killing that, you know, let people kill welcome swallows because they consider them, you know, problematic. Recreational shooting of ducks and quails. The unprotection orders that are allowed where wildlife are protected and then suddenly they're unprotected because it suits an industry to unprotect them for a while. So we're really trying to work towards just providing better protections for wildlife in the long run, because currently, you know, even when you think they're protected under things like the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals or the Wildlife Act, there are so many loopholes and so many unprotection areas that it's ridiculous. And wildlife just deserves better.
Yeah, I think, there's definitely, as you said, so many different areas to be focusing on. But, I think what is clear is that, wildlife needs to be a priority. And it's so important that there's groups like yours that are making that platform and giving them a voice. And finally, to wrap up, Mish, would you be able to point our listeners to where they can go to find out more about the work of the Victorian Wildlife Alliance?
Yep, so we're on Facebook and we're on Instagram, so you can go and check us out. We've got lots of educational content, lots of political content, that's probably your best place to find us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, we really appreciate both of you, Nat and Mish, joining us this morning and talking us through what's been happening with bird flu, specifically in Portland, and the work of the Victorian Wildlife Alliance. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Nat and Mish, who are from the Victorian Wildlife Alliance, about their efforts to humanely euthanise birds in Portland over the weekend and the broader campaign that the Victorian Wildlife Alliance has in the lead up to this year's Victorian state election. And you can find out more at Victorian Wildlife Alliance on Instagram and Facebook.
Do you have a few children's picture books or footy boots that your kids have outgrown but want to find them a loving home? Well, drop them in at 3CR and put them in the Books and Boots bin. Books and Boots regularly sends pre-loved children's picture books and sports footwear to remote and regional First Nations communities and children across the country. Contact us at Books and Boots or go to the website www.booksandboots.org.au. We love a good book.
Are you stressed about your home loan? Right now, more Victorians than ever are stressed about home loan repayments. If you're going through a period of temporary financial hardship, you can ask your lender for hardship assistance. Lenders can agree to reduce your interest rate, extend the term of your loan, freeze interest, put a temporary hold on payments, or reduce your payments. If you only own one property that you live in, and either you are affected by family violence or your household earnings are less than $75,000, contact Mortgage Stress Victoria for free help from a lawyer, social worker, or financial counsellor on 1800 572 292 or www.mortgagestress.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
She doesn't want.
DigiTube, people, place, language. Connecting stories, culture and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Up next, Jo Samuel King is the founder of the Dingo Conservancy. Hannah interviewed Jo for Earth Matters on the 23rd of August 2026. In this interview, Jo shares the important role that dingoes play in our environment and the need to protect them. Hannah and Jo discuss the difficulties of protecting dingoes, common misconceptions, and the beneficial role that they play in our ecosystems. Here is that segment.
Would you want to start by telling me about the Dingo Conservancy and what the organisation is and how you got involved?
Yeah, so my name is Jo Samuel King. I co-founded the Dingo Conservancy a couple of years ago. I did that for four reasons, really. I started to understand that dingoes were Australia's wolf, our apex predator, and absolutely vital for ecosystem health in Australia. That was the first reason. The second was that I'm from around Victoria, and I came to understand that we had dingoes in southeast Australia. And thirdly, that governments were killing them on the public purse en masse at scale. And those, and then fourthly, no one knew. So I saw this as really important to create a national advocacy organisation to see if we could ensure that dingoes were properly protected and thriving across Australia.
So are dingoes endangered? Like, how do we know how many dingoes there are currently across the continent? Or?
That is a really good question, and we don't. Because no one's been counting, because they've been treated as what are called wild dogs or pests, they're not counted. The only two populations that have been counted are in Victoria. The Victorian government did a census in 2023 as a review of dingo, as part of a review of dingo management. What they found in Victoria, at least, were that there are two populations. In the northwest Victoria, there's a tiny population called the Wilker or Mallee dingo, and that population is on the brink of extinction. There are less than 100 mature individuals there. They are highly inbred and in real trouble from a genetic perspective. And are unlikely to persist without genetic rescue. In the rest of Victoria, they're locally extinct in central Victoria, and then in eastern Victoria, there's a population of around somewhere between 2,000 to, I think it was a, around 2,000 mature individuals, and that population is declining. We, as an organisation, looked at the, what's called the catch per unit effort as a marker of population decline. That's if you set out traps, how many dingoes do you catch? Because in Victoria, government employees are paid to catch and kill dingoes. And what we found is, based on that catch per unit effort data, that the dingo population in eastern Victoria is declining to a point that they could be considered critically endangered. So what we know is, for most of Australia, we don't know. For the two populations that have been counted, they are both eligible to be considered critically endangered, and the one in northwest Victoria on the brink of extinction.
So what is the reason for the government killing dingoes, and what's the, like, public perception of them?
It's a cultural and a political one. I think it goes back to even very early settlement, where we came to this country assuming it would be like England, where the apex predator had been removed, the European wolf. And we expected to just be able to bring our sheep, which are sitting ducks to all kinds of predators. And then when the dingo did what it does, which is predate on sitting ducks, whether they be ducks or sheep or whatever it might be, we were horrified. And it evoked in us a very aggressive response to what was then called the wild dogs, and it's still called wild dogs. And we have come to this country with a very basic mentality, which is, if something bothers us, we kill it. And that's the culture that is out there right across Australia, and that's the culture that the politicians tap into, that people want annoying animals dead. That's really the rationale. And I think it's also because of that, because of a deeply entrenched hatred towards wild dogs, that's where the votes are, and we've never really properly got our heads around how to live with dingoes and how to farm, how to protect our sheep in ways that don't kill dingoes. They're out there. There are lots of options. Governments could compensate farmers for stock losses. They could call dingoes and not wild dogs. Livestock guardian dogs are incredibly effective. Absolutely, they've been proven to work and to be cost effective. fences can work, lights, all kinds of other non-lethal methods are out there, but you gotta want to.
And how do you think that we can change the public's perception of dingoes and the responses of them?
I think the first thing is to stop calling them wild dogs. We really need to get the message out there that the animals that are currently being called wild dogs are dingoes. And how do we know that? Because it's pretty easy to analyse the DNA of the animals that are killed under the wild dog program, and it's been done. It's been done by three different groups of scientists. In Victoria, it was led by Dr. Andrew Weeks in New South Wales, Dr. Kylie Cairns in South Australia, it was Ravishankar. All three groups of scientists have analysed that DNA to death and found that the animals killed under the wild dog program are dingoes. That's the simple answer. So we need to call a dingo. Now, sometimes there are groups of what are better called free-roaming domestic dogs, particularly around human settlements, and they can also be a problem for sheep. But we need to throw that word out the window. Wild dog, it's gone, it's useless, it's misleading, and call them dingoes and free-roaming domestic dogs. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we need to take the heat out of the whole debate, and the best thing to do is to compensate farmers for stock losses. And then we need to work with government to see dingoes protected right across the country, and then work with farmers to help them, instigate non-lethal methods of livestock protection.
That was an interview originally aired on Earth Matters on 23rd of August, in which Hannah interviewed Jo Samuel King, co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy. And for more information, you can go to dingoes, that's dingoes.net. And up next is our events for the week.
For events this week, on Thursday the 3rd of September at 6 p.m, Harms Industry, the Arms Trade and Commercial Determinants of Health Elizabeth Murdoch Building at the Building 06 at Melbourne Uni. Also on the 3rd of September and this Sunday, the 6th of September, the Black and Bright Writers Festival. On Saturday, the 5th of September, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., there's the Community Summit, How Can People Power the Halt of the AI Data Center Rollout at Drill Hall, 26 Therry Street, Melbourne.
And then to just do a quick run through of today's show. So first at 7:15, Fung spoke to Jana Favero, who's the Deputy Chief Executive Officer at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, who joined us to reflect on 25 years since the Tampa Affair, which permanently reshaped Australian politics and immigration law, launching offshore detention and hardline border protection policies that continue to this day. Then at 7:30, Fung spoke to artist Darcy Ruyat, who is an Australian Mauritian artist whose practice revolves around textiles and sculpture. And they spoke about the Wood Street Youth Art Prize, a biennial exhibition presented by Hobsons Bay City Council. Then we played an excerpt from Tuesday Home Time last week, in which Jan spoke to Australian-Palestinian writer and filmmaker Ala Al-Kaisi about her latest play, The Return, and also spoke about her move from Jordan to Australia, her studies in the arts and her creative practice. At 8 o'clock, we spoke to Nat Coppice and Mish Crilly from the Victorian Wildlife Alliance. We spoke about how the alliance has come together to advocate for a more wildlife-friendly government in the lead-up to this year's state election, as well as their efforts over the weekend to humanely euthanise birds infected with H5N1 in Portland, and the need for a stronger government response to protect wildlife in the wake of the bird flu. And then finally, at 8:15, we listened to a segment in which Hannah from Earth Matters spoke to Joe Samuel King, the co-founder of the Dingo Conservancy, and they spoke about the difficulties of protecting dingoes, common misconceptions, and the beneficial role that they play in our ecosystems and why we need to protect them. And I think, yeah, that's been our show for today. Definitely stay tuned for the next program, which is Accent of Women. And Tuesday Breakfast will, of course, be back next week as well. So thank you so much for listening. This has been Juliet, Elena and Fung.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
The People's Record is a podcast that looks at race, policing, and public housing. Over 5 episodes, we speak with residents, lawyers, academics, and activists about how policing has evolved and public housing communities are targeted. Listen to us on 3CR in August.
DigiTube, People, Place, Language. Connecting stories, culture, and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter. 3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.